There was some dispute as well about the circumstances of his arrest.
He maintained that he wasn't read his rights. He was asked, was he sure about this? Was he 100% sure about this? And he said, yes, absolutely. I know what Miranda rights are. It wasn't until I got to the station that I was read my rights. Well, then Mr. Bailey was handed a document and he was asked to identify if it was his handwriting. He said that yes, it was. And then a part of the document was read to him. It said, I was told I was being placed under arrest for the murder of Sophie Toscan de Plantier. Garda Culligan put me in handcuffs and I was told my rights. So Luana Brainon said, it would appear, Mr. Bailey, you were told your rights. It would appear so, yes, said Mr. Bailey. These writings confirm you were told your rights. I have to accept this account is better than my recollection. I have to suggest to you, Mr. Bailey, that you have developed a narrative in relation to these matters, but that narrative is in respect of important complaints that you make wrong. No, the narrative that you are putting is wrong, said Mr. Bailey. I want to put it to you, Mr. Bailey, that the allegations you made about a death threat being made to you in the car on the way to Bandon Station is as false as the claim that you make that you weren't told your rights. You may suggest it, Mr. Bailey replied. I would reject it. The state is also arguing that Mr. Bailey cannot claim to have been shunned locally exclusively because of that arrest when it was public knowledge that he had been violent towards Jules Thomas in the past. So today, he was questioned by senior counsel for the state, Luana Brainon, about his violence towards his partner, Jules Thomas. It is common knowledge, he said, that in the past, to my eternal shame, that when I drank spirits, I was involved in domestic abuse. I don't know what to say about it, except it is to my eternal shame and it is long since cured. He was then shown photos of Jules Thomas taken on the 2nd of May 1996 following the assault, and asked to describe them to the jury. Describe what you see, Mr. Bailey, said Mr. O'Brien. No, I'm not going to describe it, said Bailey. So O'Brien took the photos back and said, one can see a closed right eye, a bandage placed over it in another photo. It is appalling, said Mr. Bailey. It would be very evident to anyone who saw that they would have seen those injuries. Yes, agreed Mr. Bailey. There are injuries on her hand and arm and a very substantial amount of hair was pulled out. Yes, again, agreed Mr. Bailey. Would you agree that it looks like an area of 4 centimetres in diameter that was pulled out? It is appalling. What can I say? Said Mr. Bailey. Would you agree that a substantial amount of hair was pulled out? Asked Mr. Brennan again. Have I not paid a debt for this already? Said Mr. Bailey. I knew this was going to happen. It was the case that you were a man who had been seriously violent towards a woman and that this was known by people in the locality. Yes, again, agreed Mr. Bailey. Don't you think that that was relevant to suspicion falling on you? Yes, it could be, agreed Bailey. It can't have done anything for your popularity. Were you shunned? I wasn't aware. You're saying it didn't? Unfortunately, said Mr. Bailey, as we know, domestic violence is very common and there would have been other cases in the locality. Are you saying that that made it acceptable, Mr. Bailey? No, I accept that there was knowledge of what I did in the community.
What is this French connection, Philip, that Ian Bailey is talking about?
It arose, Mary, when senior counsel for the state, Luana Brainon, was reading from a Sunday Tribune article that Bailey had written about the investigation of the murder of Sophie Toscan de Plantier. The article read, or part of it read at any rate, her 55-year-old husband will be formally interviewed by Gardaí over the weekend. He did not come to Ireland to identify the body. He has repeatedly said he has too many business commitments to allow him to come to Ireland. Now, Bailey commented on that excerpt. He said, yes, I find that's quite shocking, isn't it really? I think it's shocking that the gentleman had lost his wife and he wouldn't come over here to identify her body. I can tell you this, that if I had a wife that was murdered, I would go to her at some stage and to assist the Irish police. I just find it very, very strange. Why? What conclusion did you draw? He was asked. Well, when you begin a murder investigation, Mr. Bailey said, you look for motive. Now, trust me, I'm not saying anything about him, but when you look at it, it's highly suspect. I'm not quite sure I understand, Mr. Bailey, but the impression I'm getting is that you are saying that in some way Daniel de Plantier was involved in or responsible for his wife's death. Well, Mr. Bailey said, I'm not exactly using those words. No, you're not, Mr. Bailey. You're using smoke and mirrors. I could tell you a thing or two about smoke and mirrors, Mr. Bailey said. There was a lot of information coming out of France and that wasn't being investigated. The marriage had split. She was his third trophy wife. He had settled divorces with the other two amicably. She was leaving him. She was coming to live over here in West Cork. Cork had everything that she wanted. Her life in France was way too complicated. And 1 week before she came over, there was a party at which Sophie Toscan de Plantier, his third wife, met his current mistress, whom he subsequently married. There was a catfight in a bar. I know this from Ms. Monger. This is background. And very interesting background too, Mr. Bailey. Very interesting, yes, and some very serious inquiries, Mr. Bailey said, should have been made about it. I believe to this day that there is a French connection, that there were clear indications in France that weren't being followed up.
Did she explain then how she came to make statements identifying Bailey as the man that she had seen at Kailfather Bridge when she had already said he wasn't?
Farrell told the jury how on the 14th of February 1997, 4 days after Ian Bailey had been arrested, that she went to Ballydehob Garda Station. She had met with Garda detectives Jim Fitzgerald and Jim Slattery in her home the previous day. She said they were really friendly. They said that they knew that it was Ian Bailey who had killed her and they knew that it was him that I had seen at Kailfather Bridge. We just want you to say that it was him. There'll never be a court case. I was convinced that what they were saying was right. That was the attitude I had towards Gardaí. That is the way I was brought up anyway. So she went to Ballydehob Station and while there she says that she signed a minimum of 4, maybe as many as 8 blank sheets of paper. What awareness had you of Ian Bailey at this stage? She was asked. Oh, I thought that he had murdered Sophie Toscan de Plantier. Everybody was talking about it. Everybody was convinced that he was going to kill again. The Gardaí had told me that he was going to kill again. Jim Fitzgerald, Garda detective Jim Fitzgerald, said I was going to be a great help to them. That not only had he killed her, but that he was also a very strange man, that he used to howl at the moon, that he sat on Barley Cove Beach naked in a rocking chair reciting poetry while 10 lesbians danced around him. They were really, really strange things, they'd say, and I really believed them.
She was read statements signed by her in which she identified Bailey as the man she had seen.
Yes, and at several times in response to those statements being read to her, she quite clearly responded, I don't know where that's coming from. I don't recall filling out that second questionnaire at all. I didn't make that statement. The first time I saw that was in 2006. She was read one statement in particular, which indicated that it had been given at Ballydehob Station on the 14th of February 97. It was signed by her, it was taken down by Garda Kevin Kelleher and it was witnessed by detectives Jim Fitzgerald and Jim Slattery. The statement says of that sighting at Kailfather Bridge, I immediately recognised this man as the man I had seen in Skull. I now know this man to be Ian Bailey. Did you make this statement? She was asked by counsel for Ian Bailey, Tom Creed. No, I didn't. When were you first shown the original? At the MacAndrew inquiry in 2006. Was your signature pointed out to you? Yes. Can you explain how your statement came or your signature came to be at the bottom of this statement? Well, they would have been the blank pages that I signed when I was in Ballydehob. Do you want to comment on that? They told me that all they needed was a couple of lines identifying the man that I had seen as Ian Bailey. And were you happy to go along with this? I was, because I thought that the guards couldn't be wrong. They said that he'd admit it when he was charged, that there would never be a court case.
Today, Marie Farrell alleged that one of the senior detectives stripped naked and asked her for sex. Philip Boucher Hayes was in court. How did this allegation arise?
Well, Mary, the senior counsel for the state, Paul O'Higgins, was examining a transcript of a portion of one of the so-called Bandon tapes, these tape recordings of phone calls made in that Garda station and others, unknown to many of the Gardaí working there. Mr. O'Higgins said, "There was a plain threat made by you, Ms. Farrell, to Detective Garda Jim Fitzgerald when you said, 'If you ever say anything about any of my children again, I'll give that information to Frank Buttermer, Ian Bailey's solicitor, something that will embarrass you.' What is this dark secret that you hold over Detective Fitzgerald?" "It's just something personal," she answered. "Ms. Farrell, I'm not prepared to operate in the dark in a public trial. Will you tell us what it is, please?" "I can tell you, but it's going to cause huge embarrassment." "Let's have it out." "I would prefer not to." "Let's hear what it is now, Ms. Farrell. Let's not have any hidden agendas here, please." Then Judge Hedigan intervened here to remind Marie Farrell, "You were obliged, Ms. Farrell, to tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth." So then Ms. Farrell began, and there really was no noise whatsoever to be heard throughout the courtroom at this point in her evidence, which is also the point at which I must advise listener discretion. And she said, "When I lived in Skull, I looked after a house for an English doctor. I would clean it every Saturday for tourists. One Saturday, Jim Fitzgerald called in to see the house while I was there cleaning. I went upstairs and he stayed downstairs in a bedroom. When I came down, he was stripped naked and he asked me for sex." "And what happened then?" asked Paul O'Higgins. "I told him to get the F out." That's my abbreviation, not Marie Farrell's. "And why didn't you tell anybody else about this incident since then?" "Well, it's not the sort of thing that you go round talking about." And he challenged her on this and whether the incident had ever actually happened or not. And she said, "It happened. I'm not telling lies. Do you think I want to be sitting here and now there's going to be more headlines in the newspapers about Marie Farrell that I'm going to have to explain to my children? Well, can I suggest to you, Ms. Farrell, that if you ever wanted to get out of having to make more statements to Gardaí falsely implicating Ian Bailey, as you claim, that this was the ideal opportunity, that you had Detective Fitzgerald where you wanted him. Well, if you think that I'm telling lies now, tell me then, how do I know, or how could I know, that he has a little growth low down on his stomach?" "I do think that you are telling lies, Mrs. Farrell." And then he questioned her very closely about when this alleged incident occurred, which she was unable to be specific about. "Can I suggest to you that it is dangerous for you to indicate when this happened, because if you do so, it could perhaps be proven then that it did not happen?" "I'm not going to sit here and embarrass myself by saying these things if they didn't happen," said Ms. Farrell, getting quite angry in front of the jury at this stage. "How can it embarrass you, Ms. Farrell, if some lout, some cheat, some gross offender towards women did this to you?" He went on to question her then as to why she had never told anybody about the incident before now. "May I suggest to you, Ms. Farrell, that you are no shrinking violet when it comes to making allegations of a lewd nature against An Garda Síochána Síochána. So why would you not have told anybody about this before now?" "Well, I knew Jim Fitzgerald's wife, Patricia, and I liked her." "So it didn't bother you to make allegations of this kind against Garda Maurice Walsh, but not against Jim Fitzgerald?" Ms. Farrell, you will recall, has previously told the jury how she claimed that Sergeant Maurice Walsh exposed himself to her in the toilet of a golf club and said that he was turned on by fitting up Ian Bailey. "So you were happy to make one allegation but not the other, Ms. Farrell?" "Well, I've said both now," she said.
Martin Graham took action for what he describes as purposes of insurance. What did he do?
He went to the newspapers, Mary, as he says, for security, insurance, so I wouldn't get hurt. What I wanted was backing, proof as security so that I wouldn't end up getting hurt. I wanted to keep alive. Honestly, I was fearful for my life. So he described how he got in touch with several newspapers through their hotlines. Most didn't want to know, but eventually one sent down a reporter and a photographer. "We arranged for me to call the police," he told the court, "to get them to come and to meet me and to give me cannabis, and they were going to photograph me getting into the car. The journalists searched him before he got in so that they could photograph him with cannabis if he got it afterwards. And they also gave him a dictaphone to record the conversation, but this tape recorder didn't actually end up activating during the course of the car journey." He said, That is, Martin Graham said today, they gave me cannabis in the car again, how they normally gave it to me, in a police evidence bag. And then the jury were shown photographs at this point. What are you holding in this photo, Mr. Graham? He was asked. Oh, Lebanese flat pressed, of course, said Mr. Graham, of a photo in which he can be seen holding up a smartphone sized piece of what looked like hash.
When and where is Graham alleging that he was beaten up?
Well, after several months of these meetings with detectives Leahy and Fitzgerald and cooperating with them, he said, this is Graham said, that he knew that they were onto him. He agreed to meet Detective Leahy and Fitzgerald at the bridge in Skibbereen because I couldn't get out of meeting them, he said. I thought Leahy and Fitzgerald would be the only people that I'd be meeting there. So I started walking across the bridge and I saw their detective car coming the other way towards me. But then I saw another car coming in the other direction. I didn't know who was in it. And then I was dragged off the street. I was thrown into the back of that other car. Now, there was a pronounced tremble in Mr. Graham's voice at this point in his evidence, which had been very, very clear up until that point. He was also wiping his eyes, it should be said. He described being pushed down into the back of the car and being punched and beaten in the sides and around the shoulders as the car was driven around the countryside for about a half an hour. I thought I was going to be murdered, the witness said. That sounds a bit extreme, said counsel for Ian Bailey. I had just caught police being corrupt, he said. They were possibly going to lose their jobs and their pensions. That was a big price for them to pay. They kept beating me and punching me as we drove around the countryside. They were saying, where are the tape recordings? Where are the tapes? We know you have them. I just kept on saying, I don't know what you're talking about. I felt my life was threatened, he added. What do you mean by that? I don't really feel free to say. You are free to say anything you want in here, Judge Hedigan intervened at this point. So the witness answered and he said, I was threatened with the provost. Did that have a special resonance for you? Yes, it did. I served 2 tours in Northern Ireland. Again, his voice was very shaky as he was giving this evidence. He was wiping his eyes throughout.
Now, a Garda detective involved in the Sophie Toscan-Du Plantier murder investigation has denied that a reference in a tape-recorded conversation to a statement getting chopped up was to remove evidence that might be favourable to Ian Bailey. Philip Boucher-Hayes was at day 49 of Ian Bailey versus Ireland and on Garda Síochána. What was this statement that was to get chopped up, Philip?
Mary, Detective Garda Jim Fitzgerald was giving evidence today and being cross-examined about one of the so-called Bandon tapes, these recordings of telephone conversations in and out of Bandon Garda station. The jury was played a tape in which he and a Detective Sergeant Liam Hogan can be heard talking about a written assessment that another detective had made of Jules Thomas, Ian Bailey's partner. Detective Garda Liam Leahy had described an account of events that Jules Thomas had given to him as being honest and accurate, and in his opinion that she had been telling the truth. This was the statement that Detective Sergeant Liam Hogan said should be chopped up in the tape that was played today to the jury. What they would have heard was, yeah, he has to get effing, that statement has to get chopped up anyway. Yeah, that second voice is Detective Fitzgerald agreeing with him. Then Detective Hogan says, he'll get chopped up on it in a box like. He would, of course. It F's it up. It F's it up. It is very damaging to have it there. So anyway, that was a portion of the tape that the jury heard. Then the barrister for the Bailey team asked Mr. Fitzgerald, what would Detective Sergeant Liam Hogan have meant when he suggested to you that a statement had to get chopped up? Well, he had a lot of experience of murder investigations all over the country, like, and he was often saying to me and to others that opinion and hearsay shouldn't be included in statements. Wasn't it also the case that it wouldn't look good to have a statement from a guard in which he believed Jules Thomas was telling the truth, and that was why it had to get chopped up? He just didn't want opinion and hearsay. Is it not the case, Mr. Fitzgerald, that if a guard makes a statement, it is never edited? Yes. that it can be added to in the future by way of supplementary statement, but that you would never ever discard a statement from a Garda and write a new one, leaving information out. That's right. So to suggest that a statement should be changed would be extremely improper, wouldn't it, Mr. Fitzgerald? He just didn't want to be sending things in and getting requests back for changes from the DPP.